Okay, today we are in Roanoke, Alabama, visiting with James Watson, and Mike Fleming is accompanying us here. And James is a renowned banjo picker from North Georgia, and has been involved in bluegrass and old-time music for many years. So James, if you would, let's just kind of start with talking about possibly a little bit about the first music that you heard and how it related to bluegrass and old-time music.
Well, my uncle, I had this uncle, he was an old-time banjo player, and he called it rapping, and we call it clawhammer, whatever, but he called it rapping a banjo, and he played an old tune called Shout Little Lula, and I really liked that tune, and I just wanted to play banjo bad and play like my uncle. So as I finally got a banjo, I tried to learn to play it on his, but that started me wanting to play banjo. It was a tune, Shout Little Lula, okay, and old clawhammer,
right,
and done by himself.
Would you mind playing a little bit of that for us?
Well, this is my version of it.
And you've got two or three versions I know that you play, so.
Yeah,
I slow it. Kind of hit all of them, Marver.
I'll just play it as plain as I can. I mean, Shout Little Lula in D. Getting a banjo, you know, when I was a kid, but I did wind up with a good banjo and didn't know it. You know, I didn't know that the old banjo I got now is kind of worth a little money to a collector, but I didn't really know it, but it was a good banjo. It was a 1928 Wyman student model, and Daddy found it in a pawn shop, and I got it off my dad, so that's where I started. Then I met Lee Farmer, Pappy Lee they called him. And he was an old-time singing oak fiddle player, played in G. And he taught me there was a three-finger D on a banjo, and I taught it to his son, and I went to play, I would teach his son a tune on a banjo to play behind his fiddle player, and then I would play the guitar. And I had 3 weeks to learn to play the guitar and get a G run on an old tune called Down Yonder. And I missed that thing two or three times. But Lee didn't wait. He just put us boys, it was called Pappy Lee and Chillin'.
About what year was that?
That was probably in 47 or 48. And he went on and got us back then, you'd do radio shows. You know, we did a Saturday evening radio show, and we didn't know what three chords. And he'd do over here and cackle and old stuff like that. And he got us a radio show and a sponsor, and we was for kids, and I didn't know what three chords, G, C, and D. And then we had to work like a dickens to learn the other three, you know, C, F, and G, learn how to do a tune in C, F, and G. But he kept us going, and he put us in little uniforms, you know. I think you saw that.
Right.
The black stuff, black uniform. But we didn't know how to play music, but we saw, like, with a golden reel glass, we entertained. Mm-hmm. And Pappy Lee was a good comedian, as Doodle was. And so then I would teach his boy the tunes that we was going to play on the radio the next Saturday, and we'd get letters too. Back then they'd mail you letters to the radio station, and I'd go back out there. But anyway,
what radio station was this?
WLR in Roanoke. It's Eagle 102 now. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we would do shows, and then we got on up past the chilling stage, and we kept a little old band together, and we'd set in with different ones and help out. But Then it got to be Pappy Lee and the Little Playboys. And then by then, we was playing dances. Mm-hmm. And that was a good way to make a few dollars on Saturday night. And then we kind of got to courting and first one thing or the other. And then we kind of bust up and then get back together. You know, band lasts a little while and then get back together. And then we quit. But anyway, well, finally I got with a country band. And this boy was a real good singer, good guitar picker, and I had a lot of talent. And he could teach me a tune, and I could learn it pretty good. So me and him played together along with Pappy Lee, and I finally married his sister. And he was a good singer, could write songs, could do a lot, but he kept me kind of learning. I could learn a tune quicker with him than I could with anybody. And so then we formed the Playboys, called the Playboys, with Pappy Lee and the Playboys, me and him, and his two boys. And we went from there, played a while, and then the band kind of broke up. Then I, in about 1965 or 66, I run into J.N. and Oney Baxter, mm-hmm. and Ron Norman playing banjo with him, Hugh Wiley on the mandolin, and on the bass,
McGuire.
David.
Well, wasn't
Howard McGuire was on bass. So I saw as the first three finger banjo picker I ever seen up close that would let you come around and see what he was doing. So me and Butch Adams, we'd run Norman to death after we saw that three finger picking. We just set us on fire. So I set in to get me a better banjo and just different things, and that's where I started following them around, and they introduced me to towns that had it in it. See, I didn't even know it existed around and driving. You know, I thought I could just only hear it on the radio stations. And that was it. I started following them.
There's a couple of things I'd like to hear about at this point. And one was when you went to Nashville to visit with Earl Scruggs.
Yeah, I was got enough money to get together, and didn't have no money hardly, and just, but I was thrilled to death that I got up enough money to go to Nashville and take my family. So we was,
go ahead.
But anyway, we got to Nashville, and I was just going to ride down the street, and maybe I wanted to ride by Earl Scruggs' house, you know, so I could say, I went up to Nashville, and I went and rode by Earl Scruggs' house. So I went to ride by Earl's house, and he was at the mailbox. And I stopped and said, "Hello, Mr. Scruggs." And he just turned out to be one of the friendliest fellows I'd ever met. And old Martha Whitebus was sitting out there, and his dog. And I was just thrilled to death just to get to say hello to him. I didn't dream I was going to get to even speak to him or even see him. But as it was, he messed around and made a mistake. He invited us into his house, and I wanted to buy a tone ring. I had read as Earl Scruggs said, every good banjo player ought to start with a good tone ring. And he sold them for $33 a piece. So I went in there, and he was going to sell me a tone ring, but he didn't have any. But somebody had broken his house and tore up some furniture and a pool table and stuff like that. And he had a banjo that had kicked the case in and, you know, kicked the head in and all this stuff, and he sat there for a while. He didn't have a tone ring to sell me. So he took that banjo apart, took a key, you know, and took the brackets off it, and looked at it, and he said, "If this tone ring's not been or damaged in it, I'll say listen to you." Well, I remember that tone ring. I remember him taking it out, but I didn't know nothing. And so, but I remember I was real disappointed, because I couldn't get me a brand new tone ring for the $33. So it's the tone ring that's in my old Gibson banjo, and these folks still look kind of sideways at me when I tell them it come out of one of Earl's banjos, but it did. Someday maybe I'll live long enough to get it documented, me or him one, that he remembers that. I believe he will. And someday I'd like to do that. But that is, that banjo, that tone ring that's in that banjo right there, did come out of an old banjo that Earl had in his house that folks, he said he carried it as a second banjo on the road.
Right.
So.
Well, who else did you meet on that trip to Nashville? Didn't you meet some other folks too?
Yeah, I met all of the Foggy Mountain boys and the dobro player and
Josh
Graves and then Jake Turlock and then
Curly Sacker, was he part of the group at that point?
No, it was the fiddle player, Johnny. Not Johnny was his son.
What
was
it? Paul Warren.
Paul Warren was on fiddle, and but I didn't meet Paul at Earl's house. At Earl's house, I saw the dobro player and the bass player, and Earl. So that was the thing. But I was really proud that and then I got to see Mr. Roy Acuff and him and meet Bachelor Brother Oswald. Me and him got in there, and it was Uncle Dave Macon had an old D. Gibson banjo in there in a case that he had let Roy Acuff, or his family had let Roy Acuff, put in one of the first halls of fame, I guess, or the things in the Roy Acuff music shop. And so me and Bachelor Brother Oswald, we got back there, got that old banjo out, and I played you out a little on it. But it was an old banjo, and the frosting was off on the head way up there where Uncle David frail it around. But I got to do all that and meet all those people up there. Then I had that little old bitty camera. That was a big up plus for me, was having a camera. So. And I still got some of the pictures that come out of that little old camera.
I've scanned some of those, and they'll be included with this. Well, let's move back. We'll come back to Nashville in a few minutes. Let's move back to Georgia at this point and pick back up with J.N. and Oney Baxter. And that was probably in the mid-60s or so that you became acquainted, or early 60s with them.
It was in the 60s, and I get my years confused up as to what year. I think anybody moved about like we did back then, can't keep a year straight, they'll get it in the wrong place. But anyway, I met J.N. and Oney Baxter. It was the first bluegrass people that I ever met playing music that could really play bluegrass. I mean, they had it down, and they had a bluegrass band. And it was within within driving distance of where we were. And then Boothbury was long and about that time, and that's the time I met them. I met Boothbury, and Joe Partridge was playing banjo with Boothbury at that time.
That's right.
And Joe was a three-finger banjo picker. So we got to see Ron and Joe Partridge as three-finger banjo pickers, the only ones that I've seen around there for a long time. And I hadn't met Don, Ron's twin brother, at that time. And gosh, it'd blow your mind after I met him. But I started following J.N. and Oney Baxter. And I followed them to Asheville, North Carolina, and I followed them on up to Union Grove and Statesville and just everywhere that they went. I was just glued to their bumper, and I wouldn't leave them alone. I followed them. And they was they just put up with me and let me just follow them and learn and see and meet people. And I've always been a guy who got out there and met people, and I've done that. So.
Okay, now let's get back to your banjo picking a little bit at this point. This is something that I want to explore also. You have developed a unique style of playing the banjo. Can you tell me a little bit about how you developed that style?
Well, the only thing I can really figure out is when I first was playing country music and all, it was a lot slower. And I would try to get into jam sessions in a bluegrass festival. You know, and I'd find a fan bluegrass, and I would try to, you know, speed it up, you know, the style to where that it would kind of wouldn't knock everybody out of time and everything else. So I had to learn a whole different style of my clawhammer, you know, to stay in jam sessions after I'd met J.N. and only them. It was totally different. So that's what I did. I took my old style and began to put a little different left hand progression in it to be able to stay with a bluegrass band. And then that was before I ever joined Doodling them. I had already kind of, you know, picked the style up to where I could play clawhammer almost at the speed of of bluegrass, you know, that they were playing at that time, which was unusual. Banjo player, clawhammer banjo pickers just didn't pick it with that drive that I was searching for. So I just kind of, I just kept at it till I got it to work and I got it to fit.
Well, what about picking a tune for us at this point? And just anything you want to play.
What do you want to hear?
Well, of course, you've got John Hardy. You've got several of those. McKinley that y'all did a long time ago there. Rabbit in a Log. There's just anything that you feel comfortable in playing.
I'll pick John Hardy. Me and O'Carroll Wilmington has picked this thing. They picked this tune everywhere. Just about in the southeastern United States we've ever been together. I think it's a lot slower now than I did though.
Your right hand. You're not doing any kind of dropping of the thumb onto the strings other than the fifth string. But yet are you doing a lot of hammer-ons and pull-offs and that kind of thing?
Yeah, on the right hand, I never could learn that drop thumb. So I just had to pull them off with the left hand. I believe I could play faster than I could if I was dropping my thumb, but I can't play slow stuff near as well as I should, you know. It's like an old slow tune, I can get through one just, but not too slow. Here's one. Let's see.
One that I want to hear you do sometime before we finish here is Log Cabin in the Lane.
Yeah, I like that old tune.
That's one that you can do a little bit more slowly and really get all the subtleties in too. And so on.
Yeah, I hadn't picked in a while, but I'll do the best I can to get as much of it in as I can. That's a beautiful old tune. It was I'm trying to think of the name. He's a Georgia fiddle player. Recorded that. Well, the first one to ever record that.
Fiddling John Carson.
Fiddling John Carson, that's right.
First thing he recorded.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
He was from Atlanta, Georgia.
Yeah, Cabbage Town, that's right.
And but that was a pretty tune. And I don't think he wrote it anything, but he's the one that made it famous. And he did it in Atlanta. It was one of the first recordings ever done. And I like that tune. If I can remember how it goes, I'm going to pick it, Faith. I'm going to pick it for myself, too. I like that tune. I'm going to pick it for old Mike Fleming. He's sitting over here, too.
Good man.
Let's see. Thank you.
Play one that is a very poor substitute.
This
belongs to me
good
at this
banjo.
Point.
It's real good.
And, so.
Well, I appreciate you letting me play it on.
Oh, well, I tell you,
I broke string on that.
Sounds really good. Yeah. Well, let's get back to. So you were headed into playing some bluegrass, but actually playing clawhammer.
Yeah.
And as I understand it, there was kind of a little. I think it would be called serendipitous. Incident where you ran into a doodle thrower in a parking lot somewhere.
I sure did.
I heard a preacher preaching, and I, having a granddaddy that was a Baptist deacon, I'd always been around preaching, and so I hear this guy preaching. You know, I was going down an alleyway there at Marietta, Georgia, at the Southeastern Bluegrass Festival, I guess. So what was the name of the festival? This Marietta Festival?
Marietta?
Yeah.
Georgia's Best? I don't know.
What
yeah,
else?
It
was a
Cobb County.
It went a long time. Cobb County.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it was. And I heard this guy preaching. I went down there, and I could always kind of rap along and play a little behind the, you know, gospel music. And this guy was doing, I saw a light and two or three more that I could sort of hit him with. So I went down there, and Doodle was preaching, and he was blowing his harp, and I got to playing with him. He turned around, and he said, boy, that goes together. You know, the harp and the way you play the banjo kind of fits. And so we just stayed there, and I reckon me and him stood there for hours. And we used to do that, just stand for hours. Your feet would just, you get to where you couldn't even feel them. I know Mike knows that feeling. You do, too.
Yep.
Stand till you can't feel nothing, but you're having a good time. That's the thing about this music. It is good time. I believe it'll make you live longer and be lots happier in life. But anyway, I met Doodle Thrower, and David had a bluegrass band, and they had two or three good three-finger pickers, but every time one of them would have to be out, I'd be in there like glue, and I'd stay and play with them. And I played with them through the year of 74, but they were still wanting to do a bluegrass band, and so Bill Key didn't want to hire me as a banjo picker because I played clawhammer. Then I got to, Bill know the 1,000 tunes, and I know some of them, so I got sitting down with Bill and picking the tunes that he knowed, and so he was sort of like Doodle. They began to fit with him, and so when their banjo picker was out, well, I'd be in there. So I got to where I was playing more banjo and more. And by 75, they hired me as an official banjo player. And that's how I got hired. Because I convinced Bill Key, you know, that, and then we began to get booked as old time band. National Council of Arts kind of run upon me and Doodle. And that's where we began to go out then. We put together a pretty good show, and between that and the National Council of Arts and Norman Adams Bluegrass Festivals and such as that, we just went from there. And for 18 years, we rode and drove and went up and down this whole southeastern United States, I guess. And I got...
So y'all played together for until 93? Was it 93 that Doodle passed away?
I think it was
93 or 94, maybe some... It was 93, I guess, because it was right before the peach blossom. When I was or was it 93, 94, somewhere in there.
Yeah, and then we played on about a year with this group that's up here on the wall now. Mm-hmm. With Jerry Wesley, the fiddler, and C.J. Clackham came back, and me and Wesley and Gene Daniel. Gene, me and Gene was the two, we outlived them all, or outplaced them all. We just stuck, you know, so that was it. When, but we decided to give it up after Doodle was gone. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't the Golden River Grass no more. It was just, so they went on, and I've just been playing up here with a little local band called Randolph County String Band at M&M Music Barn every third Saturday night. And that's about it with my playing now, you know. And so
you've been, for the last 5 or 6 years, you've been playing pretty much the local area here. And,
yeah. It's the first time I ever played at home was after I quit the road and come back. I never did play in Randolph County because we was a Georgia, General Doodle and them was Georgia based, and I was the only one from Alabama. So I had an hour's time difference to make up and about at least a 70 mile ride to catch them on Friday. And I was raising family back in too, and that's kind of hard to do.
Well, let me ask you about, I've got a couple more topics, and then we'll probably come back to the Golden River Grass. The first topic, Grandpa Jones. Tell me a little bit about how you met Grandpa and some of your associations with him.
Well, I had always played Grandpa Jones music, and he was one of my idols in any kind of music. Earl Scruggs was the other one, you know, so in the banjo line. So, but we were doing a show in Dover, Delaware. And he was booked on that show, and I had never got to meet the man, and I had just always worried about something happening to me and him one before I got to meet that man. So his dressing room was just across the hall from ours, so I really wanted to meet Grandpa Jones. So I got my banjo, went out in the hall and tuned it, and I played 8 more miles of Louisville outside of his door, and he come out and say he was playing it, and so I got to stop it to it. Then I asked him, I wanted to record Going Down the Country, and I wanted to change it and put 2 C's in it instead of one. And I asked him, well, if I did, would it be all right if I put that second C in it? He said, do anything you want to with it. So it's been good to me. Do anything you want to with it. So when I got him to do that tune for me, and I got out front to see him perform that, and he was going to sing that song for me. And so somebody in the audience said, why don't y'all do one together? Because we'd done our show, and my style wasn't that far from Grandpa's. So Grandpa called me up out in the audience to come up on stage and do, you know, that we'd done John Henry. I was so scared. When I was coming up the aisle to get, I actually never got out and got up there on stage, but I was coming up there, and I hit my banjo, and it was completely out of tune with him. I said, oh, done lost my chance. But something just said, try, and I capoed the A, and I was dead in tune with him. So Grandpa Jones tuned his banjo up in A and didn't use a capo. And luck was just with me, and God smiled on me. And I got to play John Henry with him in Dover, Delaware in 1984. And that was really just like a football player winning the Heisman Trophy to me. You know, it was that thrilling. And then everywhere that he played, you know, and like at Dahlonega and at Jekyll Island and different places, if I was there, I got to come on stage with him, just at different places. So, and in my scrapbook, you see Grandpa Jones, Grandpa Jones, Grandpa Jones, you know, all over. So,
and you also went over to Mountain View, Arkansas?
Yeah, I went out there. And 85 and 86. I come in fourth in 85 and third in 86. And in the Clawhammer Banjo contest out there. And then I got to spend a little time with him, talking to him, and just sitting around back rooms, just different stuff. Mm-hmm. And I really, really enjoyed those visits and meeting the man. And he brought me a book to Jekyll Island. I got it over here in this drawer, you know. In the front of it, he wrote a bunch of stuff in there to me personally, and I thought a lot of it. And he remembered my name, you know, and that was highly unusual. for somebody of his stature to remember who I was or remember my name, I thought. So that's it was Grandpa Jones. He was a great fella and one of the nicest people that you're going to meet. I mean, he had time. Well, if he had time, but he told me, he said, sometimes I don't have time. I'd like to stop and talk to everybody, but I just don't have time. And right. Then you've got to set your sights and walk through. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And I can understand that.
Let me ask you about another clawhammer banjo player that is well known to a lot of people, although I have a feeling probably he was gone before you really got into the music and got to traveling. This was David Stringbean Aiken.
Yeah. I met Stringbean in Atlanta, and he'd come out of a club up there that he was playing, and but he was trying to show me his lick, and I was trying to show him mine, and they was so we could play the same tune, and it was sound sort of alike, but our licks were so different, and his was so fast, and that was that's the limit with Stringbean. Was I was trying to catch his style, and I couldn't catch it, and he had a style. I don't believe, ain't nobody got a style like Stringbean, though. You got to really listen to Stringbean, but he was a good picker.
Oh, yeah.
He picked two fingers and two, but he had a style of clawhammer that I just never seen anybody come up with.
Now, Mike Seeger is a person that you've crossed paths with
before. Yeah, too. Mike's a good friend. I love old Mike to death. He always took up a little time with me. And I didn't know who he was when I first met him at Bean Blossom, Indiana, Bill Monroe Festival. So I got to pick on stage with him and Hazel Dickens and another girl. So, Mike. And then I played the World Fair and spent a lot of time with Mike. I spent a whole week with him in a boarding house down there where they kept us at the World Fair. So I got to visit a lot, and he knows a lot. He's just good people.
Okay.
Joe Player, clawhammer.
All right. James, I'm just remembering back several years ago, me and the other guys in Brushfire was in Nashville for some reason, and just drove by a motel out there off of Briley Parkway, and there you stood on the curb. What were we all doing up there?
It was the Spigma bluegrass thing, but I had one up there with some people from Florida. Me and that one-armed guitar player, you know who
I'm talking about?
S.J. Hall was supposed to go on Ralph Emery's show that night. And so I got a free trip up there. And the hotel was even free.
You take it
from Florida. Yeah, I'd caught a bus and was riding on a Florida tour bus. And I didn't have no way to get around. And I was standing out on the corner, and here come Mike and him through. I waved him down, so I had a way to ride the rest of the time.
We spent the rest of the weekend
together. And had a great time. Then the Forrester Sisters won some kind of big award that night, so we got what's called bumped off of that show, Ralph Emery's show. And so we went down to Stigma in big old hotel, and I'm trying to think of Larry Perkins was a banjo player. And Leroy Troy. And so I was hanging out with them, picking down there in the hallway. And y'all was out in the big part, and we had the hallway blocked down there.
That's right.
So everybody was there in bluegrass. All the big names was there, I guess. Brushfire.
And yeah, all the big names.
And all the big names. And I had a way to ride, man. I stuck it to Red Fox way down the other end of Nashville. No way to go except my big old tour bus, out of Florida. But I was real grateful to them people, paying my way and letting me go. And all I was going to do was accompany S.J. Hall, because he was a super fella to be able to play a guitar with one hand.
He was.
You heard him.
Mm-hmm.
So he could really do it. And I was just going to accompany him because, I don't know, me and S.J. always liked each other, and he just chose me, and I got to go. Jack, and I really thought he might have wrote that tune down in the mountains up there, but he really didn't, because I heard Ralph Stanley play it after I began to see bluegrass, and I knew that my uncle didn't write that tune. So this is the way that I play it, sort of.
Contest one time, I believe.
Yeah, that was all kind of, all different kind of tunings. I didn't know there was that many tunings on the banjo, but there's a lot of them that I didn't know about. That Shout Little Lula, I've seen it played, you know, in what's called High Mountain C, a double C, and it's a pretty tune, but that was just my version of it, sort of. It wasn't the way my uncle played it either, but that was a tune that set me on fire to play a banjo, some which way. I just knew I had to do something with a banjo when I heard that tune. Old Stanley Walker said the same thing happened to him when he heard Shout Little Lula. He knew that he had to play a banjo.
Well, now, while we're talking about this, one of the tunes that you used to do with the Golden River Grass and Doodle, of course, was McKinley. That was kind of a signature piece.
Did
you feel up to playing a little of that?
Yeah, I picked a little of it. That was a good tune for us. We got a lot of encores with McKinley, I guess. And old McKinley getting shot kind of put Theodore Roosevelt in there. Let's see, McKinley.
Thank you. gonna do a CD, me and you.
Yeah, I really would love to get my picking back. I miss it so much, but I know I'm never gonna have the speed. But you don't have to have that much speed. That was just the Golden River Grass tradition. No dragging.
More than anybody else, that was their style.
Yeah.
A little bit more about your days on the road with the Lake Doodle Thrower and the Golden River Grass, and so if you could give us a little bit of information on that, just share some things, whatever you feel like.
Well, working with Doodle Thrower and the Golden River Grass, that's Gene Daniel and Bill Key and just different ones that come through, C.J. Clapham and Wesley, and just everybody that ever played with the Golden River Grass. And it was just a thrill and a joy for me to get to work with those people. And Randy Franks was one of them, and just different ones. But Doodle was an amazing man. It was just being one of the Golden River Grass to me was just a real honor and a highlight. And we had a lot of fun. We had a lot of times it wasn't so fun. But we had a lot of good times riding up and down the road all over this great country, getting to play our music and do our thing. You know, that was the thing. We had a good time. We didn't make a lot of money, but we made enough finally. Doodle had got enough notoriety where we was making gas money. And I would have played it and paid them, but as it was with Doodle, he was just an extra. Good old boy talent, I guess that's what you call it, humorist. And we got to go to D.C., you know, and do the Smithsonian, and it was Wolf Trap, which was part of the Smithsonian, you know. And then we got to do the World's Fair in Knoxville, got to meet a lot of people. And then we did a lot of Norman Adams festivals and a lot of other people's festivals. And the Horsepins 40 in Alabama was about the biggest festival we done in Alabama. Then we did one down in Central Alabama Music Park, and all the big guys was there, and Bill Monroe and everybody else. And a few days after we left from there, I was hoping to get to play again. Tornado come through and blow the music park away. But we had a lot of stories like that up and down the road to tell, but just traveling up and down the road to different places, we'd go play colleges, you know, for and I'd have to do a banjo, banjo workshop. And I at first did not know what a banjo workshop was, you know. And Doodle sure didn't know what no harmonica class or workshop was. And he'd get frustrated, I would too. But all I had to do was just sit down and pick the banjo and blow the harp. But we had to learn all those things, and we did them together, and it was just a great time in life. I guess it's one of the, it was for me. It's an old country boy, Flohama banjo picker. And I met a lot of people in this music, and all of them was great, all the way up and down the road. But I met J.N. and Oney Baxter, and they was a bluegrass band I could go up and say hello to and see them, and I followed them a long ways. Then I met Bulls Burr, and then he raised up Mike Fleming over here.
That's right, we came
off of Bulls Burr. So I go way back in it. I don't forgot now how many years it might be. It's over 30, I know. And I wouldn't take nothing in the world for my memories of being a Golden River grass boy and being a part of the bluegrass and them accepting me and me Clawhammer, you know, in bluegrass. But I was real fortunate. I got to do all those things. I got to meet a lot of people and loved every one of them.
Okay, I've got one last question, I guess, here. I'd like for you to just tell me a little bit about where you live here in Alabama, what you do for a living, and that type of thing. Maybe give a little bit about your background.
Yeah. It's not for tax purposes.
Okay. I'm a house painter. I've been painting about all my life. And we've farmed and cotton milled, and I've so I couldn't make a living, neither one of them. So I started painting. Seen I couldn't make a living hardly at painting, but I learned how to live on my salary. So that had a lot to do with it. And I kind of bought a few old houses back, you know, years ago. Because I could drive a nail and cut a piece of board up, and I'd drive together an old house and just keep it. So I sort of got in a rental business in a small way, but anyway, that's what I do. I paint houses. I got two old cotton mills. Used to have to work 8 hours in the mill and paint 4 hours on the side. That's to raise a family. And we was just cotton millers and farmers, and I'm a house painter. So.
Okay, and this is in Roanoke, Alabama.
In Roanoke, Alabama, a little cotton mill town, and the mill's gone. Y'all come by up there as you're coming in, I know. And,
okay, but now, you were born where?
I was born at Malone, Alabama, on the dead end was sharecropping up there on the call of Stone place. And that's where I was born, on Mr. Stone's place. Call of Stone place at Malone, Alabama. There's not even a town or nothing there now. Just a graveyard where my family was buried up there. And that's where I came from. There and up on the river at Wheat Hour, where the Edmondsons was my mama's people. And my uncle who played the old banjo, he was from Wheat Alley, Malone, too.
Both of them just, I knew there was a Wheat Alley connection there somewhere, mm-hmm. and I couldn't remember exactly where it was. So. Okay.
It's sort of like Roanoke and Rock Mills. It ain't very fair up the river and down the river to each other, but it's a long ways around the road, but it ain't fair down the river to each place. So that's how my mom and dad met. And so we was from Wheat Island, Malone, and this mill village. I count this mill village here, where I still live, here on the cotton mill village in Roanoke. I've always kind of counted this as home. Mm-hmm. I lived in Rock Mills 18 years, and it's a good place, and I love it. But it seemed like when I came back to Roanoke and spent the first night here, I felt like I'd just come back home. Because, you know, I count this mill village here as home. And that's about it.
Well, James, I really appreciate you taking your time with us here today and sharing some of this information and letting me scan some of the photos and get some of this great music and so on. And hope to see you out at some of the festivals over the next little while here and see you get back to doing some picking. And we'll mention that the last few tunes that James was doing was on his banjo. So he, rather than the clunker that he was playing in the beginning there, so which was mine. So this banjo that James has quite a history, and he's related a little bit to you about the tone ring. And I think this particular banjo, as I recall, you said it was a 1950 bow tie originally,
yeah.
And an archtop.
I bought it from Ron Norman. The original banjo part I bought from Ron. I've modified it and changed it up since then, but the last part I bought for this banjo was in 1968. Uh-huh. And it's been basically the same ever since, except for having it refretted every once in a while.
Right.
And it's everybody's got one instrument they wouldn't part with, and that's mine.
Okay, yeah,
so
that's a great instrument there.
That banjo you got is a new style, and that's a highly developed banjo that you've got. I'm just not as used to playing it. Each person will adapt to his own instrument.
Yeah, it's amazing how when you get used to playing one instrument, you pick up another, then it's not like playing.
That's right.
It may be set up exactly the same and so on, but it's got a different feel and so on to it. Well, James, thank you so much. And as I've said, I hope to see you out picking again before too long, and hope to get to hear you play some. I want to thank Mike Fleming for also coming along with me today on this. And we've still got a few more photos to identify, and I think we'll be pretty well set.
Yeah.